Welcome to the Beverage Report. We're excited to have with us Professor Brian Kaplan, a renowned author and professor of economics at George Mason University. In the second part of our conversation, we will discuss his ideas on having more kids, why he challenges feminism, and why he believes we should reassess public education spending. Special thanks to Aditi, Alyssa Donker, and the LSE Economics Department for making this episode possible.
You do have another book called Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, are there any selfless reasons to have more kids?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a chapter in the middle of the book saying, suppose I convinced you on the main thesis, but you're not having kids out of guilt. All right, well, why would someone have guilt over having kids? Well, we all know the answer. There's basically all of the green arguments against population, right? So there, you know, kids cause pollution, kids cause congestion. Right. And you know, this is true. Right. However, that is a very one-sided view because human beings also have a whole lot of positive externalities. These negative externalities get a lot of attention. The positive externalities get almost none. So let me just walk you through the really big positive externalities. All right. The first one is super philosophical, and a lot of people just reject it on philosophical grounds, but I swear it makes sense. And it's this. Suppose that your parents have been 1,000 pounds short of wanting you. Your parents do the mental calculation. And they're like, another kid would be almost a good idea for us, but we're like 1,000 pounds shy of wanting that kid, so no kid. Right. From non-existence, would you not have offered your parents 1,001 pounds of your future earnings to have you? Would you not have offered them 100,000 pounds, 500,000 pounds? Would you not have basically done everything you possibly could to go and change their minds to go and have you? Yeah, you probably would have. What this means is that there's what someone called an existence externality, where there's another person that can't be born without your help. They are incapable of bargaining because they don't exist yet. And yet they totally would have been willing to go and pay you this. You say, well, that's kind of weird. Well, this is how economists think about all externalities. This is how economists think about air pollution. It's like, well, there's a whole lot of people who would have paid you to go and not pollute, but there was no convenient way for them to go and get you the money. But still, we go and we count that disvalue to them as a loss to society and then say this negative externality, right? Or how about a sleeping person, right? You know, do economists believe that a person who is asleep can go and be worse off from something? I think we do. Well, you think about, you know, like, so what about also, like, is a baby so different from a sleeping person? No. What about a fetus? No. What about a person who is totally unconceived? Still seems like there's an enormous gain to that person. And by the general logic of how economists think about transactions costs and externalities, we should count it. Now, I know there's some people saying, no, line in the sand, I refuse to consider this. I have some friends who are like that. And I'm like, all right, fine, okay. All right. But anyway, then we move to the stuff that is totally indisputable. All right, here is the really enormous benefit of human population in general and to increasing human population, the big positive externality of having a larger population. And it's this, well, go and talk to anyone who knows the story of economic growth and say, so why is it that we are so much richer than people were 2,000 years ago? The answer that everybody will give you is it's because of ideas. We know we have more now because we know more now. All of the ingredients necessary to make an iPhone existed 10,000 years ago on Earth. It's just that people didn't have any idea what an iPhone was or how to do it. All right, now, next question. Well, where do ideas come from? They come from humans. All right. And you would think that, so the more humans, the more ideas. Is that true? Yes. There is a pile of economic research, some of it done by Julian Simon. The more famous person who did this is Nobel Prize winner Michael Kramer. So just take a look and say, is it really true that in places in the world with more population, they have more ideas? Yes. Is it really true that in eras when there's more population, there's more ideas? Yes. All right. So yeah, Iceland has contributed very little to Western civilization because there's hardly any people there, right? Per capita, Iceland does great. But they still have done almost nothing because they don't have enough people there, right? And on top of this, it's not just that you need more people for more ideas. You also need more people to incentivize idea creation, because when there's a larger customer base, then this means there's a greater payoff to coming up with a new idea. There is a terrible TV show from the 1960s in the US called Gilligan's Island. There's, I think, seven people on an island. One of them is the professor. The professor's always coming up with great innovations using coconut power on the show, right? But the key thing is, all right, suppose that the professor comes up with an idea worth one person, worth a penny per year per person. On that island, that idea is only worth 7 cents. If you get it off the island, then that idea is worth $80 million per year. All right, so that is another big part of it. And you can see this in things like movies, languages with few speakers. There's very few languages in that movie, or very few movies with that language that are made. Furthermore, you also see the most talented people in those countries don't make their movies in their own language usually. They go to Hollywood and they make movies in English. So yeah, like if there's some guy who does a great movie in Romania, all right, people say, oh, what a great movie. Now let's go and move him to a place where he has a lot of customers so he can actually make a serious contribution to human well-being. So that's a really big one. Another one, this is what I will call the, you think of it as the choice externality. Now, whenever you listen to a person who lives in a city complain about all the bad things about living in a city, right? Are you in London? Yeah, you are. You're in LSE, right? All right. Do you hear people complain about problems of being in London?
Quite often, yeah.
All right. And yet there's the fact, that there's a whole country that isn't London, right? So why don't you move there? Yes. And here's the thing. It's cheaper outside of London, a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
All right. So then what is the show? Well, I have a slogan that I love: actions speak louder than words. And what the fact that there are so many people who pay a lot of extra money to live in places with all the problems of high population and high population density, the fact that they say that they stay there and in fact pay a large premium, it shows through their actions that despite all the problems of being in an area with a lot of people, all of the good things of being in an area with a lot of people are even more valuable. Basically, anyone who lives in London is saying through their actions that I value all the good things of being in London more than all the bad things of being in London. And if you were to say, well, London would be great if it weren't for all the people, wrong. Without all the people, London wouldn't be London, and the stuff that you like wouldn't be there anymore. You wouldn't have the economic opportunity, the career opportunities. You wouldn't have the consumption opportunities. You wouldn't have the social opportunities. All of these things are what you enjoy by virtue of being there, and yet actually you don't really pay the people who create all of these incredible options. They don't get the surplus. Rather, it is the person that lives there. And of course, the person who owns land manages to capture it. That's very important, especially because of housing regulation that prevents us from building, it prevents you from covering London in skyscrapers to get the price of living there down dirt cheap, as is totally physically possible. But regulation doesn't allow it. That's the book I'm working on right now. I would say that these are the unselfish reasons to have more kids: to go and give life to another person that will really appreciate it, to go and contribute to the further progress of mankind through both the possible creation of a creative person and the definite creation of a person that will inspire creative people, and then also expanding the choice options of humanity. Think about the person that would have married your kid if you had that kid. Now they're going to have to settle for second best, right?
You received advice from your friends not to title your book "Don't Be a Feminist."
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose to keep the title?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so my latest book is called "Don't Be a Feminist: Essays on Genuine Justice." I have never proposed an idea that has made my friends more afraid for me, which in itself I consider informative. Yeah. So either feminists are really scary, or people are at minimum very afraid of them, whether they're scary or not. I wrote a piece just saying, when I walked into a room, my children's friends ran away in terror, I would say, was it something I did? Am I really that scary? And if they say, no, that kid's really, he's just very timid. So, well, what can I do to put that kid at ease so he doesn't run away in terror from me? That would be my reaction. So if I were a feminist, I would at least be troubled by this level of fear that people have for the movement. Why was it that they told me not to do it? Yeah, they say like this is going to ruin your career and these people will come after you and you're going to discredit all the rest of your work. right? And these are good friends who told me privately. They weren't trying to embarrass me or anything. They had my best interest at heart. Why I stuck with my guns. The main reason is, we'll say a few things. One is I was less afraid than they were. So I said, look, there's a chance that they will go, they'll come for me, but I think the chance is just a few percent. I'm willing to live with that chance. I've got tenure, so it's just hard for them to really hurt me that much. The main reason is like the title accurately captured the thesis of the lead essay. And I couldn't think of another title that was an accurate description of what I was saying. The whole point of the lead, the point of the essay, it really is, the subtitle is A Letter to My Daughter, and it's all framed as I'm trying to convince my daughter to not be a feminist. Right now, if people were saying things like, should you be a feminist? I said, well, that's not really what I'm saying in that essay. I claim to have the answer, and I'm trying to convince other people, but I think I've got it figured out. I'm not really that confused about this question, right? So there is that. Now, the other thing the argument that stuck with me more and that I did consider more heavily is, look, everything else you're doing, you're talking about Dale Carnegie, how to win friends and influence people. This is a title that will alienate people that would otherwise be persuaded by the message or at least open to the message. And this I did weigh more heavily. I said, is this true? Right. And my final decision was no, because the title is on the cover of the book and you can show your readers the cover of the book. The cover of the book is me homeschooling my daughter and we're both happy. Right. And I'm teaching her supply and demand. Right. And I think for someone to look at the title and the cover and then say, this is an angry person, they would just have to be a very unfair person who would not be open to the thesis. So I thought the art so full, puts the title in context, right? And honestly, my goal is not to make feminists angry at all. Like my goal is never to make anyone angry. I've already dealt with enough angry people in my life. Ideally, I will never encounter another angry person again for as long as I live. That is a fantasy that I have, is just to live a life where I never again see anger in any human being firsthand. But what I would like to do is just to say, hey, like you're mistaken. Like in the nicest possible way, you are deeply mistaken. You have committed yourself to a view that is deeply false and harmful to others and yourself. And there's no shame in admitting you're wrong. I do it all the time. And yes, I understand there's a certain bitterness to admitting error, but there's also a great joy in admitting error because from now on, things will be better.
Who do you think is the target audience for the book?
Yeah, who's the target audience? So first of all, of course, my daughter. Right? And you may say, well, she's too young, but I think she'll read it eventually. There's a whole book with you on the cover. How can you not at least read the first essay? Anyway, it's a question that's of some interest. And furthermore, I have a lot of credibility with my kids. I'm not just bragging. This is just simple truth. Why do I have so much credibility? Because I never lie to them, ever. Right? When other people tell me about Santa Claus, I didn't immediately say they're lying. I just didn't say anything. But whenever my kids ask me a question, I give them the truth. The most I'll ever say is, I'll tell you, ask me again after dinner. But other than that, I answer questions to my kids truthfully. They see this. They see that when their mom says, oh, well, this food is great, you're going to love it. They don't believe her because she's lied to them a bunch of times. Instead, they look to me and then I say, 30% chance you like it. I'll give them that. I'll even say, look, I like it, but there's only a 30% chance you'll like it. Right. And then I've done this for their entire lives. So yeah, I have high credibility with my kids. So I think my daughter will actually read it and take it seriously at one point in her life once she's old enough to care about this stuff. In terms of other people, let's see. I mean, of course, like anyone who likes my stuff, but obviously, like anyone who just feels like they have been bullied by feminism or that it's more complicated than feminists have told them, I think that's another audience. So there's that. Yeah, I mean, someone who is a diehard feminist, I don't think is going to give the book a fair hearing. But I think there's a lot of people who just say, it just seems more complicated than what I've heard. I'd like to go and hear what the other side has to say about this. So I think there is that as well.
In your book, The Case Against Education, you put forward the argument that education should not be subsidized by the government.
Mm-hmm.
If you could, how would you structure public education?
So I'm not allowed to go and reduce funding. I just have to change the way that we spend the money.
Yeah, or you could cut all the funding.
Yes. Well, so again, my first best choice is just to a separation of school and state. I know this is a radical proposal that will persuade almost no one. It's not the heart of my book where I just focus on more, you know, I'm more pragmatic, but I also thought that people would say, well, what do you really think? And all right, fine, I'll have a page where I tell you what I really think. Yeah, so, I mean, like in general, my big cause is educational austerity. I think that we spend way too much money on school. And as a result, people spend way too many years in school. This is, I think, a view that people find easier to accept. Again, like the heart of the critique is credential inflation. As education has expanded, the main result, which we can see very clearly in the data, is not that most people wind up getting a high status job, but rather that the amount of education that you need to get the same job that you would have gotten otherwise keeps going up. Right. So basically, it is true that over time, the level of the jobs have become more cognitively demanding. But almost all jobs have become, the amount of education need have gone up, regardless of whether the job has become more cognitively demanding. So basically, I'd say that roughly 80% of the rise in education has been sucked up in credential inflation, only 20% in moving people into more cognitively demanding jobs. And again, what's going on is what I call the signaling model of education. Just the main thing that the main reason why school pays isn't that you learn useful skills in school. Most of what people teach you in school is not of practical value anyway. The main reason why education pays is that you are signaling that you are better than other students, which is a great way for you to, you know, so basically getting a degree is a great way for you to look better than other kids, get a better job. It is not a good way to enrich a country. All right. Now, in terms of my main solution that I push is austerity. Let's spend less. High education spending has caused credential inflation. Reduced spending will cause credential deflation. If you get the share of people who have finished college down, employers can no longer say, I want college graduates to work in my fancy restaurant. The other thing I say is we should have more career and vocational education. There's research on this. It looks pretty solid, saying it's really better for, definitely for the students who focus in it, it's better for them. It's in general, it looks like there are gains to almost anyone of getting some more of this because it gives you some more practical experience. And definitely better for society because it is so practical. It's not so signally. In terms of what I would do if you said, look, you can't go and cut spending, you just rearrange it. It's the main thing that I would do for younger kids is say, look, there's going to be two things we do here. One is learn literacy and numeracy. The other one is play and do whatever you feel like. The end. Right. So I think that right now, at least in American schools, I'm guessing in British schools too, basically, kids are getting bossed around all the time. There's been a de-emphasis upon actually learning reading, writing, and math. That's true in the US, but that doesn't mean that the kid can enjoy life. Instead, it just means that you give them busy work all the time, which adults pretend like kids love, like singing and dancing. A lot of kids don't like singing and dancing at all, right? So what I say is, look, here's what good school for little kids would be. Give them, kindergarten, give them, start them off with 2 hours of reading and writing math. You have to do this stuff, tough luck if you don't like it. And then the rest of the day, you could do sports. You could play with other kids. You could be in the library, whatever you feel like doing. We're not going to, there'll be a teacher around so that kids don't hit each other. That's it. And then every year, add another half hour of reading, writing, and math. All right. So that's basically what schools would be like if I were running them. And then once you get up to, to age about 12, this is where we say, okay, now, guess what? You're going to be an adult. You got to find a job. Let's find something that you like and are good at. And that's where I would just start exposing kids to a whole lot of different career options that are realistic. I would not do the thing that we do in America right now. It's like, oh, you could be a poet or an historian or a novelist or a painter. It's like, yeah, those are jobs for 200 kids per year. What's left? Right. Instead, I would go and expose kids to realistic jobs like elder care. Right. We know there's going to be a lot of people working there. Let's go and show them about that. Let's go and show people about working in a restaurant. There's going to be a lot of jobs about that. And sure, let's also show them CS and tech and that kind of thing. And just give people 4 weeks each in a bunch of different jobs for between the ages of, say, 12 and 14. And then during that time, if the kid ever says, oh, okay, sold, I found something I like. All right, great. We're moving you into something where you learn a lot about that. Right. And at the end of 2 years, they still never, oh, we're going to move you into something that seems like it's still your least bad option anyway. Right. And then some kids are going to be going and getting prepared for more academic type jobs. Some kids are going to be getting prepared for other ones, but at least they're learning how to do something. Right now, I know there's a lot of people say, oh, well, what if you prepare them for a job that disappears? Yeah, well, it's better to prepare them for a job that might disappear in the future than for one that doesn't exist at all and never will, like Poet, which for all practical purposes is absurd. Like, look, you may say, well, we don't know how technology will change the economy. You know, that's true, but here's something I will predict with 99.999% certainty. There will not be a lot of jobs for poets in the future. Right? So, no reason to spend a lot of time trying to get kids to become poets.
Perhaps education is more so suited towards their intellectual learning at earlier stages. In fact, what's your rebuttal to that?
My answer is there's a whole field called educational psychology. They desperately want to believe that what you said is true, but they've been studying this question for about 100 years and almost no one who knows the data believes it's true. I mean, when I was starting on this, I found it a little hard to believe, but then I just went and read everybody that I could. And so basically what psychologists call this transfer of learning. It's the idea that you can take something you learn in one area, you learn general critical thinking or thinking skills, and then you transfer it over to another area and it's going to work out great. And the answer is that's pretty much non-existent in the data. It must happen sometimes because some people do apply things, but for the overwhelming majority of the human race, if you are lucky, they apply exactly what you learned in school. And normally that doesn't even happen. Normally they barely learn what you teach them. They forget it quickly. And, you know, so it is not true if you teach a kid geometry that 10 years later, when he needs to go and put up some drywall, he's going to use geometry. This is not how human beings actually learn. It's not how they apply knowledge. Rather, you know, human beings need a lot of learning by doing. They need tons of repetition and they need it to be very directly relevant to the exact context. People are terrible at taking something from one context and putting it in another. The only real debate I would say in educational psychology is whether there is some better way of teaching that would actually accomplish what they have failed to accomplish so far. What I found there is there's a whole bunch of educational psychologists say, I've got the magic bullet. If we just use my method, then we'll get transfer learning. But I couldn't find a single one that had convinced anyone else that they had the magic bullet. There's like 10 guys who each say, I've got the magic bullet. No one else thinks they're right. So I thought, I don't know, maybe one of them does, but I don't really see any way to adjudicate this besides devoting my life to the subject. Anyway, what everybody who works on this agrees is that existing education systems barely produce transfer learning. So yeah, it is just not it is not practical to think, or it is not a reasonable assessment we're doing now to think this is happening. And nor is it realistic to think that we could start doing it. Far better just to go and try to prepare people for plausible careers. Knowing full well people might change, but at least they learn how to do something, learn how to be part of a team and show up and do that kind of thing. So that, as I say, something that would be better than the system we have. So, I mean, the UK used to have more of a track between vocational and academic education, right? You've moved in the American direction, if I recall, correct? Yeah. Yes. Turn around. Turn around. America is the opposite of the way. Go to follow the Swiss. They know what they're doing. Not the Americans. Americans are screw-ups.
You have highlighted the importance of being a nonconformist. What is a status quo position that you believe is especially harmful and why?
That's a really good one. There's so many. I mean, during COVID, I would just say following COVID rules. Right? And being, you know, like, and being a low-risk person who remains isolated and basically ruining years of your life for what? So, but you know, that was a very specific one during that period. I was very much, again, of course, there were some very high-risk people who it made sense for them to adjust their behavior. But even there, if I had been 85 years old, I would not have wanted my family to isolate me. I would have said, I want to take the risk. I don't want the last 2 years of my life to be this living hell. Right? I don't want to be in solitary confinement. I'd rather take a 10% extra risk of dying. right? In term, but you know, like more generally, let's see. What are the most harmful ones? Probably actually being afraid to go and make new friends and reach out to people. So like we all, so there's so much to be gained by making new friends. I have the slogan, friendship rules the world. Just going and assuming the best of other people and going out of your way to meet new people. You know, this is considered unusual by most people. But you know, most people, they're so afraid of doing it. It's like, I can't just go and talk to that person. The internet has actually helped because people are a lot more comfortable emailing a stranger than talking to a stranger face to face. But even there, there's a lot of nervousness. But I would say that, yes, there is a social norm that you don't just go up and talk to strange people. And I would say that is it. That is like, yes, you're conforming to it. Other people don't do it. You should do it. You should fearlessly go and just approach people and try to and see what happens. Right? You know, like, so like most of the time it won't work out, but so what? So like sometimes it does. And if you do it often enough, you'll get a great portfolio of friends. Yes, I'm very strongly in favor of people just going and asking out on a date, like almost anyone that they think might be promising, right? And this is one where I know there's high anxiety, right? And I had it when I was young. If I was single now, I just don't think I'd have much anxiety, right? Again, I would not recommend just say, hello, want to go on a date with me? I would, you know, ramp it up a little bit, but, you know, still like very low anxiety. Just try it and do it. See what happens. Right now, per my Don't Be a Feminist book, there are some people that will bite your head off, and there's actually a few places you might get fired or like sent to the principal's office or whatever. Right, so be aware of that stuff. Also, be aware that most people are not monsters. Most people are not looking for an excuse to ruin your life just when you say like, "Hi, want to go out with me?" You can do better than that, obviously. Right? If you want to improve as a guy, you can go to YouTube and watch a clip from the movie, The Tao of Steve. There's a lot to that. Although, honestly, I would say number one thing is you miss 100% of all the shots you don't take. So just try. Let's see. Plenty of other things. I mean, this is not so much conformity pressure as just a big mistake that I think especially young people make, especially young men, which is put too much focus on looks. I mean, honestly, like if you are dating the most attractive person in the world, but they have a terrible personality, you're unhappy. Bottom line, right? Maybe not for a few weeks, but like goes on much longer than that. You're unhappy. So why not just go and skip to realizing, hey, personality is really important and I should focus. And that's what I should focus on. And I mean, for young people, I also say, yeah, practically all of you look great. So yep. you're all really good looking practically. So what's the big deal anyway? Just go on personality.
I mean, not to do it would perhaps be the social consequences of rejection, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that?
Right. What I think about that is in a primitive tribe of 40 people, the social consequences of rejection are devastating. Everyone finds out they're rejected. You might mess up your prospects for life. However, in a modern anonymous society, the social consequences of rejection are near zero. It's all in your head. You have the psychology of someone who imagines that everyone that you see right now is going to be in your social world for the rest of your life. Totally wrong. Probably you're never going to see these people again after the class ends. Therefore, I'm not using that. Don't use this excuse to be a jerk to other people, but don't worry about rejection because the consequences of rejection are basically in your head. One of my favorite lesser known psychological biases is something called the spotlight effect. It just says that people think that other people are paying a lot more attention to them than they really are. Originally demonstrated in experiments where you get a person and you say, hey, wear this stupid t-shirt. It's an embarrassing t-shirt. Now walk through that room. All right. And then ask the person, how many people do you think noticed your stupid t-shirt? And people think a lot noticed their stupid t-shirt. Then ask the people in the room. Do you notice that guy's t-shirt? Like, what guy? That's the way the real world works. So yeah, don't worry so much about what other people think about you. Treat other people with common decency. But yeah, rejection is just something that it's very important to get over. Warren Farrell, the founder of male feminism that I was mentioning, one of his big things is women should ask men out so that you don't get stuck with having to choose between guys that have the guts to go and talk to you. You might say, well, I don't want to go out with any guy who doesn't have the guts to talk to me. yeah, well, guys with the guts to talk to you in today's society tend to be jerks. So, right, if maybe you should go and look at a guy that is, look around, hey, there's a guy who's shy, but he's a really nice guy. So maybe you should go talk to him. Maybe that would work out better for you. So yeah, these are all, you know, another piece of advice that I think is good. Yeah, women shouldn't be scared to go and ask guys out, right? You know, there's always the person saying, oh, well, women do ask guys out, just not in so many words. Yeah, and the guys who are asked this way have like a 2% chance of noticing. Young guys are clueless. And like, if you just say, hi, I would like to go out with you. Oh, okay. But if you just go and say, oh, wow, you're really great at Spanish. It's like, oh, I guess I'm good at Spanish. Okay, moving on. I say, yeah. You know, like in general, people are not good at reading social cues. I don't say this because I'm so great. I've improved though. So yeah, like one thing you can do is just be a lot more straightforward and direct with people, right? Again, not to scare them. So like, again, not to like, you don't want to go up to 100% direct, but go up to 90% direct. I think that is good advice. And especially for young people who are just don't have a lot of experience with dealing with other people.
You have an upcoming book, Build Baby Build, The Science and Ethics of Housing. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a teaser as to what we should expect the thesis of that book to be?
Absolutely. I have already written one nonfiction graphic novel, which is Open Borders, The Science and Ethics of Immigration. It's been my best-selling book. It's been my only New York Times bestseller. I think it's also my most persuasive book because I really did harness the power of combining words and pictures to communicate much more effectively, to pack a lot of information to a short amount of reader's time, and also just to make friends with the reader. In real life, I'm just a normal human being. I don't have the best personality. I have trouble striking the right tone. But in Open Borders, my artist always draws me with the correct personality, right? And with the correct attitude. I'm always, and I really micromanage him saying like, make me 7% more sad, that kind of thing. Right, in order to go and really communicate the feelings that I want to communicate. Build Baby Build, The Science and Ethics of Housing is another nonfiction graphic novel. And the idea is there is a pile of high quality academic research on a really important question that hardly anybody knows about or cares about because it's just in obscure academic journals that nobody reads. And furthermore, also because the researchers themselves just don't really put the whole package together to go and show people how it means something really important. In Open Borders, I put together a pile of research on immigration to say, tear down these walls, the more immigration, the better. In Build Baby Build, I say we have a pile of terrible housing regulation that is strangling the construction sector. This is causing immense harm, not just in terms of raising the price of housing, but there are many other indirect effects that are also terrible. And if we would just go and if I can take all this research and communicate it away that is fun and gets people to see the enormity of what we are tackling and why it is a societal shaking reform that we should all get behind, then I'll have done my job. So I think this graphic novel format is great for this topic. Just to give a quick preview. So actually the UK is even worse than the US on housing regulation, but basically this is basic. It's basic economics, people. It's basic economics. If you heavily restrict the supply of something, it raises price and a lot, right? So in the US, roughly speaking, it looks like we have raised housing to double the cost of production. I think in the UK, it's probably more like triple. It varies by where you are in the country. This is an average. So it's terrible in San Francisco and London, for example, not quite as bad out in more remote areas, but the average is really bad and almost anywhere that people live is bad. You can go out to the middle of nowhere in the UK. I actually was driving around some parts of the middle of nowhere. Let me see. Like, what was the thing? Like the giant, what was it like the Vale of the White Horse. All right. So probably you could get a cheap place around there, I'm guessing, or maybe 10 miles away, but hardly anybody lives there. Basically anywhere that a lot of people live, housing prices have been shoved up to a really high level. This is not normal. We have historical data on what housing prices used to work. Here's how they used to work. Demand would go up. There would be this would raise the price of housing above the cost of production. The construction industry would rush in and build a ton more housing, and the price would go back down to the cost of production. This is how housing used to work. Now, when demand goes up, the construction industry wants to build a lot more, but it is so hard to get permission to do it and in the quantities required to get it back down to cost production that it doesn't happen. What kinds of regulations do we see? Maximum height restrictions. There is no reason that London could not just be covered in giant skyscrapers so that you could live cheaply and spaciously in downtown London. We have the technology. We've had 100 years. We've been able to build massive skyscrapers. It is a bit more expensive to build the super tall ones, but you can get to 40 stories at a very reasonable marginal cost. And yet you know that London does not have a minimum height of 40 stories. And that's regulation. They want to knock down those old buildings and replace them with skyscrapers. They can't get permission. All right. There's also a lot of regulation on multifamily housing. This is more common in the US, where you just say you can only do single family homes. Regulation that says the minimum size of the lot, where you have to use at least an acre of land, so you waste most of your land. There's parking regulations, environmental regulations. You have that terrible green belt in the UK, this giant area where you can't build anything around London. I talk to people, how often do you actually go and enjoy this nature? It's like hardly ever. So then what's going on? Well, remember I was talking about social desirability bias. It sounds great to say, oh, this green belt is so important. Why is it important? Like, why isn't it more important to give cheap housing to 5 million more people? Yeah, so pretty silly. Now, in terms of, you know, the other effects, so the obvious one is drastically reducing the cost of a big part of an item, which is a very large part of people's budgets. You know, cutting the price of housing in half or by three isn't like cutting the price of chewing gum in half. You are greatly reducing the price of one of the biggest parts of people's budgets. So this means that we're getting a large increase in living standards very easily, just as a free lunch. Then on top of it, there's also some really cool evidence showing that the productivity of workers is higher in these high paid areas or in these high cost areas. If you could get the cost of housing down, a lot more people would move to these high productivity areas. And then you would get a large increase in GDP just from reallocation of population. It used to be that people would naturally move from the low productivity areas of countries, the high productivity area countries. This is no longer true. Now, actually, we see reverse migration. People go from the high productivity areas to low productivity areas. Why? Because the extra cost of housing in the high productivity areas exceeds the productivity gain. So you actually do make money by moving away from productivity now inside of countries. This also makes a big difference for inequality and poverty. The poor spend a higher percentage of their income on housing. So make housing cheap, you especially benefit them. Tenants also are poorer than homeowners, so you benefit them. There is a great paper by economist Ron Lee, who showed that all of the rise of capital share and income really comes down to just housing prices going up. It's not some big story about the necessary evolution of capitalism. It's just housing regulation is making housing prices artificially high. Anyway, there's a lot more in the book that I talk about. There are big environmental benefits because cities are greener than countryside and new buildings are greener than old ones. So historic preservation is bad for the environment. So we'll let them knock down the old buildings and replace them with modern stuff that is high energy efficiency. All right. So basically, after immigration, I say that housing deregulation is the biggest free lunch for economic policy reform.
And a question we ask all our guests, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope? Honestly, it is my children that give me hope. I see my kids, they're alive. I love them so much. And whenever anything good happens to them, it happens to me. Friendship more generally, spending time with friends, making new friends. In a way, I'd say yes, making new friends is what gives me the most hope because it's like, hey, new cool things can happen for me. I've made a new friend. There's that. So in terms of like other things, politics, hardly anything ever seems good to me. I mean, I did a piece where I just said, look, since the fall of communism, it's hard to come up with any really good thing that's happened in global politics. Right now, there's a lot of things that have happened great for the global economy and technology. That's different from great things that have happened in global politics, but I think it's just been 30 years of, at best, things stay the same and they're screwed up. For economic progress and for tech, it's great, but it isn't what makes me feel great. You know, for me, it's being with my both family, being with friends, making new friends, seeing my kids make new friends. That's oh great, you know, my kid made a new friend. That like to me, you know, that's something in a way that means more to me than me having another friend. Many of your readers are probably asking themselves, well, where can I access the work of Brian Kaplan? And the answer is you can subscribe to my Substack. That comes out usually 5 days per week if you want a high and constant dose. If you just want to go and actually read my life's work, I believe you can get it right off of Amazon, whether regular Amazon or Amazon UK, or I guess Amazon UK is regular Amazon for you guys. So yes, all my books should be available there, including my three latest books, which are collections of essays of my best blog posts for the last 20 years. And there are five more such books forthcoming. So collect them all. All right. So fantastic talking to you, and hope all of you have a great day out there. Bye-bye.